It's a timeless question for gay couples. And the answer today seems to be yes. California strikes down a ban on same-sex couples tying the knot, paving the way for June weddings. Marriage is made in California's high court. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, May 16th. California becomes the second state to make gay marriage legal. Is this a tipping point or the beginning of a moral standoff over gay rights in America? Also, the question of intervention in Myanmar. Television takes yet another look at its business model, and an office icon turns 40. That and all the news. Same-sex couples in California could be taking vows as soon as next month under a ruling by the state Supreme Court yesterday. The justices struck down state laws banning same-sex marriage. San Francisco's Mayor Gavin Newsom had this to say.
What the court did is simply affirmed their lives, affirmed their rights to live their lives out loud the same way that many of us take for granted that are getting married each and every day across this country.
Opponents say the decision is a threat to traditional marriage. They're hoping California voters will overturn the results by approving an amendment to ban gay marriage in the state constitution in November. Already, 42 states have laws banning same-sex marriage.
In China, the confirmed death toll from Monday's earthquake has risen to more than 19,500, but the government expects that figure to more than double. It's already more than doubled in Myanmar. The UN says still only a small fraction of the supplies have reached hundreds of thousands of cyclone victims. The UN World Food Program estimates it will have to rush 390 tons of food every day to reach a significant number of victims over the next month.
Lebanon's government has agreed to join political talks with Hezbollah. Beirut's airport is open for the first time in a week following the worst violence since the Lebanese Civil War. Iranian-backed Hezbollah took control of the capital last week from rival Christian and Sunni militias and government troops. The Arab League will broker talks beginning today in Qatar. The BBC's Jim Muir reports.
The dialogue is expected to be intensive and to go on until agreement is reached on two thorny issues: the balance of power within the proposed national unity government and a new general election law.
President Bush is wrapping up his two-day visit to Israel and heads next to Saudi Arabia. Oil prices are expected to top the agenda in conversations between Bush and Saudi King Abdullah, which have already started.
It was a promotion meant to keep people driving, but instead it caused more congestion. A phone company offered a free tank of gas to drivers at a station in Las Vegas as part of a promotion. The stunt ended up tying up traffic for miles, and at least one driver ran out of gas while waiting in line.
Probably stocks. Wasn't too thrilled about
it. No. That was a bad bet there. The Dow settled at up 94 points yesterday. The S&P added nearly 15 points. We're asking a question today. It's about Myanmar. The question is, with 2.5 million people at risk without aid and the crisis worsening in Myanmar, what should we do? Is there a motive or a reason to intervene? You can leave your suggestion at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We have a response already, actually. I think the United States should invade Myanmar only if we had accepted aid, foreign aid, for Katrina.
That's from Derek in New York. We'll be back.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
That's some very happy gay couples yesterday celebrating outside of California Supreme Court after an historic ruling legalizing same-sex marriage. Now, it was a controversial split decision coming down 4-3 with a majority ruling to throw out a state law passed by voters defining marriage as limited to unions between a man and a woman. The court found the law in violation of the equality provisions of the state constitution. California is now the nation's largest state and the second to allow allow gay and lesbian marriages after Massachusetts. Brad Sears is executive director of the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. A very controversial decision. Explain the court's reasoning.
Yeah, I think the court basically held that two parts of the California Constitution meant that laws that limited marriage to different sex couples were unconstitutional. One was some provisions that create a right to marry, and the court defined that as extending to same-sex couples as well as different sex couples, basically any two adults who want to have their family recognized by the state. And an even broader part of the decision, the court basically said that laws which discriminate against gays and lesbians are treated with the same sort of suspicions that courts treat laws that discriminate against African Americans or other people of color, that the court will really look closely at laws that burden such people and, in this case, strike them down.
And you're really talking about a level of scrutiny called strict scrutiny, which is the highest. But there were many people who came out right away and said the court has no business making this decision. Let's take a listen to one critic.
Okay. It is not the function of the court to redefine marriage, to redefine terms. That is a legislative act. What the court did in overturning the marriage laws is essentially enact legislation from the bench.
Did the court enact legislation from the bench? And what's the argument to pro and con, Brad?
I think that's basically the split that you see in the majority decision and in the two dissents, is that the court and the majority decision is saying, hey, we're doing our job here. We're supposed to look at the Constitution, see if laws comply with it. In this case, using our precedent here in California, we believe it doesn't. The dissenters say just the opposite. The court is overstepping. They should give more deference to the legislature, and in this case, even more deference because the people of California passed part of the laws that they struck down through an initiative process.
And there will get another opportunity if those people who are putting forth this ban on gay marriage are successful on getting it on the ballot in November. But let's talk about what the practical impact would be at this very moment. For those people, somewhere around 4,000 people who got marriage licenses, gay couples in San Francisco in 2004, does that mean now that their marriages are legal, or do they have to reapply and go through the marriage ceremony again?
They would have to reapply. I mean, if you basically think of three groups of people, here's the impact it'll have. For those who got married before in that month in San Francisco, they're not married now. They're going to have to get married after this ruling takes effect.
What about outside of California? Are these recognized marriages everywhere in the country? Is there federal law or some sort of precedent that forces states to recognize California's marriage status?
No, it's just the opposite. There's a federal law that says other states don't have to recognize same-sex marriages if any state like Massachusetts, and now California, does so. What is different about this decision as opposed to Massachusetts is for the first time a state has recognized same-sex marriage and is going to allow couples from other states to come to it to get married. So Massachusetts had a similar decision, but they had another statute which more or less ban couples from around the country from coming to Massachusetts, getting married, and going back to their home state. So I'd expect to see a lot of wedding tourism among gay couples in California.
This is an issue, Brad, that many states have been grappling with. At least more than 40 have some kind of law in the state banning gay marriage. But the issue is still on the table in Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York. In your mind, all of this state activity coming down on different sides of the fence, I mean, does this lend itself to ending up in federal court at some point soon?
Eventually it's going to. I mean, as I said, there's this federal law saying that states don't have to recognize the same-sex marriages from other states. That could be challenged on the federal constitution. No one has done so yet.
Professor Brad Sears, we're going to have to leave it there. Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. John?
Our other focus this morning is, of course, on China. The survivors are being pulled from the rubble in Sichuan province. Very dramatic pictures this morning. Also grim pictures of funerals as Chinese authorities intensify the rescue and recovery effort to reach earthquake victims. The death toll stands at more than 20,000 this morning. It's the worst disaster in China in more than 30 years, and it caps weeks of turmoil for China preparing for the Summer Olympics and finding itself under the unaccustomed scrutiny of the entire world. The unrest in Tibet, which dominated the headlines just last month, has not gone away. Joining us now is Nicholas Kristof from Kashgar, China. Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times, of course. Can you give us an update, Nicholas, on the unrest in Tibet? It's faded from the headlines, but I suspect that the situation is as tense as ever.
Yeah, I was able to travel quite widely in greater Tibet, not in the formal Tibet Autonomous Region, but in the parts of Qinghai and Gansu provinces where there are a lot of Tibetans. And I was struck by, first of all, just how widespread the uprising really had been in the last couple of months. Every little town had had some kind of demonstrations by monks and by local people. And secondly, I was maybe not surprised, but struck by just how ruthless the crackdown was afterward. There had been an awful lot of monks arrested in town after town. Almost all of them had been beaten and warned not to talk to foreigners. There's an awful lot of fear in these towns right now.
You know, if we step back for a moment, I mean, if you take Tibet and the earthquake situation, which I know you didn't experience personally, but just looking at the aftermath, even from your perspective there in Tibet, this is an enormously significant moment for China on the world stage, if you combine these two stories.
Yeah, it sure is. I think that, you know, China, when it initially applied for the Olympics, it thought this was going to be a great coming out party and a chance to showcase its really extraordinary achievements. And I think that these days they probably think, you know, why on earth did we ever apply for the Olympics? Because it's also been an immense challenge. And this was supposed to be an auspicious year in the Chinese calendar because of the eight in it, but it sure has not proved to be very auspicious after all. And every critic of China has really tried to use the Olympics as a window because they see vulnerability there and to raise their concerns. And the Tibetans are one good example. There probably would not have been this unrest if it hadn't been for the Olympics. And then, of course, the earthquake is one more challenge for the leadership to take on. And I think maybe one thing that it hasn't been fully explained is that in the Chinese context and in the context of Chinese history, any kind of natural disaster like this takes on special resonance because there was always a view that when a regime was coming to an end, when its mandate of heaven was being withdrawn, that there would be natural disasters. And so it becomes really important for any Chinese government at any point to show that it can handle a disaster and handle it efficiently and quickly. And that's, I think, one reason why the government has really done, I think, very well on it so far.
Nicholas, how do you think the devastation and the travesty and the absolute sadness of the earthquake and its aftermath, does that temper criticism on Tibet? Does that make people step back and temper what they've been saying about the communist government in China?
I think maybe for a brief period it will. And I think it also showcases something that China does pretty well, which is infrastructure and being decisive and doing things quickly. And indeed, Prime Minister Wen Jiabao was on top of this right after it happened, flew to the area immediately. They got it in a way that Japan, after the Kobe earthquake in 1995, just absolutely did not get.
Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times, thanks for joining us, correspondent and columnist for the New York Times in Kashgar, China. You know, Kristof's book, China Wakes, is a fascinating look at China emerging from the Cultural Revolution and, the 1980s. But now I would say China is even more awake.
Oh, there's absolutely no question. It's been a fascinating year. And they, of course, hope, the Chinese government hoped, that this would be a banner year of reintroduction to the entire world. And they find themselves in the midst of controversy and disaster.
Well, it's also interesting from our end, too. I think, when Nixon went to China, it was an opening. We learned so much more about what was going on in China. And there was much, much more to learn. I think the earthquake and what's going on even in Myanmar is a window into China to see how they respond. I mean, Kristof's point was so amazing, this mandate from heaven idea. The bar is very high for a regime when a natural disaster happens in China because of the way they view the mandate from heaven.
And I wonder how that's going to play out in the longer term, in the midst of mourning and all of the aftermath of that. How is that people going to feel about the government and the response and the very fact that the earthquake even happened?
Strong spiritual connection and very political in China. More later.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. High winds and severe rains are pounding the river lowlands of Myanmar this morning, compounding a situation that has left more than 2.5 million people at terrible risk from the cyclone that tore through Myanmar 2 weeks ago. To this day, most of those people, 2.5 million, have yet to receive any needed aid because military rulers in the country have refused to allow international aid workers and supplies into the most desperate areas.
And in our ongoing coverage of Myanmar, also called Burma, we talked yesterday with Chris Kay, Burma director of the World Food Program, and here's a little bit of that interview.
So this is a hostage situation.
It's not a monolithic government. It's not a group of people that all think the same, not at all.
I understand that, Mr. Kay.
But at the operational level, who fully understand what it is.
I totally understand.
They can't seem to get their seniors to understand.
But you're describing essentially a hostage situation where 2 million people are being held hostage, and all you're doing is negotiating with lower-level people.
Well, it's not that we can't. It's not that we're only negotiating with lower-level people. We can't get access to the people who we really do need to speak to.
As in many places where this disaster is being robustly talked about and debated and discussed, many of you had different ideas. A number of you thought perhaps some of the questions were aimed at the wrong guy. Alan from New York wrote to us saying you were unnecessarily rude to the rescue organizer, seeming to blame him for the Burmese government's ugly stance.
I mean, in fact, on our website, I'm getting hammered over my treatment of Mr. K. But the larger point was how impotent the international community's response has been so far to the disaster in Burma. Yes, the World Food Program is attempting to get aid in, but certainly they don't have the capacity to actually deal with the standoff with the Myanmar government. And that's the question. What should happen?
What should happen is exactly the question, and one that's being discussed by many people, including a British columnist who thinks Western governments are dragging their feet and should step in. Simon Jenkins joins us. He's a columnist for The Guardian, and he wrote recently, "As Burma dies, our macho invaders sit on their hands." Simon, you say this is the best case for humanitarian intervention that you've ever seen. What's gone wrong in your mind?
I think we're talking about a country a long way away that doesn't admit journalists. And for that reason, there is no head of steam behind direct intervention. I mean, my point is more one of double standards. I mean, we've all been sitting watching both our governments gaily intervening in Kosovo, in Croatia, in Bosnia, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, Sierra Leone, Somalia, with no compunction at all about confronting a domestic government. Here is a case for intervention. I'm not saying it's overwhelming, but here's a case for intervention where nobody's trying to topple a regime. No one's trying to open fire on foreign troops or anything like that. We're simply trying to go in with protected convoys, as we did in Croatia, to ensure that people who are dying, hundreds of thousands of people who now face death, are saved. It's as simple as that. And we've got ships offshore. Everyone's waiting with millions of tons of aid. They're not going in out of this curious deference to the Burmese regime, which has not the slightest intention of giving an inch.
And Simon, what do you think motivates that inaction?
I think it's partly an exhaustion that we've got so many wars we've got involved in all around the world. I think we feel, as I said before, that Burma's a curious, distant, not very interesting place. It's very noticeable that in China, where far fewer people appear to have died, blanket coverage in the world media because the media are allowed to get there. I mean, I'm pretty cynical about this. If you keep journalists out, you won't have any trouble, is what it boils down to.
Although it's quite a different thing to say that an intervention, an actual invasion or military intervention in Burma is a simple matter. I mean, what are the complications in this particular part of the world, putting aside the, I think, useful comparisons that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I'm not a strategist, and I'm not there, so I'm very careful. I'm making what might be called the legal case for an intervention. We heard the American admiral who landed in the plane last Monday, having made the offer to the Burmese government to fly in from offshore ships. Piles of aid to designated locations to fly out before nightfall. He wasn't going to invade anybody. If it was contested, then clearly you'd have to provide air cover. But all one is doing is taking desperately needed supplies ashore. People now know where it's badly needed. It's not a matter of just dropping them by helicopter, by parachute. I just cannot believe it's beyond our wit to do this. I mean, we've done it all around the world.
But Simon, what about the idea that at this perilous time, perhaps you make it worse by creating a situation where you're potentially in conflict with soldiers, as you are again trying to get those basic necessities to the people who need them?
Well, I remember the convoys that went into Croatia. Did we worry about it then? We're confronting a highly interventionist ideology in both Britain and America at the moment. I mean, these are rulers who have absolutely no compunction about invading other people's countries, where for some reason or another it suits either their political interest or their commercial interest, or frankly their humanitarian concern, which is totally legitimate. In Kosovo, we went to war with the Serbian government in order to save the people of Kosovo being driven out of their country. They were being killed, but not in massive numbers.
You speak of Kosovo and Croatia, but I notice you don't speak of Rwanda as a trigger or as an example here. Do you think Rwanda is a useful lesson in when to intervene?
Rwanda was phenomenally difficult. I mean, it is, and most of us are ashamed of Rwanda. The United Nations is sorely ashamed of Rwanda. I mean, if Rwanda occurred today, I think there'd be, I hesitate to say, because another case is Darfur. But at least in those cases, the West could argue that it's very, very difficult to get supplies into areas where actual fighting is going on. In the case of Burma, nobody's fighting anybody, and these people have been totally neglected by their own government. It's not as if we're having to confront a government. The government's just not there. And all we're doing is coming in from ships that are sitting offshore, delivering aid. I cannot see the problem.
Simon Jenkins, we'll have to leave it there. Simon Jenkins is a columnist for The Guardian and the London Sunday Times.
Now time for more headlines from Femi OK. Femi?
It's 28 minutes past the hour, and in the news this morning, President Bush is in Saudi Arabia to talk with King Abdullah about high gas prices. The average price of regular gas is now $3.79. In international news, Myanmar's military government is still strictly controlling aid into the country. Despite the official obstruction, some aid agencies are managing to help the cyclone victims. Alexander Richter from the German St. John's Ambulance Organization managed to bypass the junta.
The government told us you can bring the aid into the country, but you have to give it to us. So we thought about it and we found ways to bring this aid directly to the people in this area.
Burmese ministers have met with the European Union, where once again they were asked to allow foreign aid workers into the Iradi Delta. Rival Lebanese leaders are holding talks today to try to end a drawn-out political dispute which has pushed their country to the brink of civil war. Representatives of the pro-Western Lebanese government and the Hezbollah movement are meeting in Qatar. And that's a quick look at your international headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We're going to return now to our big domestic story. By a vote of 4-3, the California Supreme Court overturned a voter-approved ban on same-sex marriage, and by doing so, set up the possibility that same-sex marriage will be a significant issue in the 2008 presidential election. It may be premature to know how that will be the case, but what is the consensus in the United States generally about same-sex marriage? Do Americans oppose it, or do they support it? And what's the regional breakdown? David Mashey is a senior research fellow at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. David, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Is there a consensus in the United States on same-sex marriage, sex marriage, and if it's moving, where is it moving to?
Well, there's been a relatively stable majority of public opinion in the United States in opposition to same-sex marriage. It's hovered from sort of the low to mid-50s to the low to mid-60s over the last 6 or 7 years. It's gone up and down a little bit. The last time the Pew Research Center did a poll on this issue in 2007, 55% of the American people said that they opposed same-sex marriage, and 36% said that they supported it. There has been a little bit of movement. I mean, if you look at the trends, there's been a little bit of movement, a little softening of opposition to same-sex marriage, but not certainly a great or dramatic shift of public opinion.
David, how does that break down regionally?
It tends to be because more conservative people tend to oppose and more liberal people tend to support same-sex marriage. What you find is that in the parts of the country where there tend to be more political and social conservatives, like the Midwest and the South, there's a greater opposition to same-sex marriage. And again, in parts of the country where there tend to be more socially liberal people, like the Northeast or the West Coast, you get less opposition.
But what's really interesting is there's an enormous gap in age. In other words, according to your surveying, 67% of those age 65 and older oppose legalized same-sex marriage. And adults under the age of 30, 49% favor allowing gay and lesbian couples to wed. Now, that's really interesting.
It is very interesting, and I think, I'm sure that advocates for same-sex marriage probably take heart from those statistics. I think that there were probably two reasons, and I'm not sure we know exactly how important each of them are for that breakdown that you just cited. One would certainly be that people growing up today or who have grown up recently have grown up in an environment that's different toward gays and lesbians than the environment that, say, people who grew up, say, 30 or 40 years ago did. There's less discrimination.
That's the broad impact of culture, whether you're, influenced by television positively or negatively, just merely having it in play has an impact on people who grow up in that environment. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And mm-hmm. I think that the second thing is, certainly some people believe that, younger people tend to be more open. And as people age, they tend to be more conservative. The old Winston Churchill remark that if you're not a communist when you're young, you don't have a heart. If you're not a conservative when you're older, you don't have a brain. I'm not saying that that's the case here.
Well, it's not exactly a bumper sticker for the 2008 presidential election,
right.
But certainly you've given us plenty to think about as we contemplate this decision vis-a-vis the election. David Mashey, Senior Research Fellow, Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, thanks for joining us. Oh, Wither Television. We're going to turn the page and talk about what is normally a festival here in New York. The upfronts, the networks, they roll out their new fall TV shows and try to tantalize advertisers into spending billions and billions of dollars on advertising time. But this year, it's extraordinarily underwhelming. And here to explain why, Mary Elizabeth Williams is the Takeaway culture critic. ABC only has two new shows.
Slim pickings. And Fox only has two new shows that they're rolling out. And one of ABC's new shows is a game show from Ashton Kutcher. And the other one is a retread of a British drama. So there's not a lot that's really original out there. A lot of the new shows, the few that are coming out, are either game shows or they're remakes of international hits. It's a very, very conservative fall season.
There's a creativity drought possibly here, but it's also a business story.
There is definitely, I guess, a creativity shortage in America, among other things. I think it's, well, part of it is, you know, a lot of people are saying it's because of the writer's strike, because of the fact that ABC has said they were not going to greenlight anything, they were not going to put anything into production that hadn't already had a pilot, and nothing was piloted this winter. This would have been the time for them to be shooting pilots, and they weren't doing it because everything was shut down. But part of it is also these diminishing audiences. It's terrible. We've lost 6 million viewers since last May sweeps. This is the sweep season.
Six million in one year.
So is it really a sign of the times? I mean, two sounds incredibly paltry, but what's also interesting is ABC was the only one who had their upfront this week, and in years past, you had a week of, like, all of the networks laying it on thick about what they were going to offer us for the following year, but not so much anymore.
It's become a non-event. It's, you know, if you imagine sort of Fashion Week not happening, it's kind of like that. It's like nothing is happening now. What NBC has done is they have said they're not going to do upfronts anymore. They're basically just going to a 52-week schedule of programming. They don't have a season per se. Fox has always done that. The CW, what they've done is they've rolled it out earlier. They're going to be starting their fall season a week earlier than everybody else. Everybody's sort of trying to figure out how to game it. And the way that they're doing it is by placing themselves separate from the pack as opposed to being part of this collective festival-like feeling of excitement.
Does this mean the advertisers have more control over the situation now? I mean, it used to seem always at those upfronts as though they had the advertisers over a barrel and Jeff Zucker would be up there on the stage at NBC going, you will pay, you will pay.
I don't think anybody has control. That's kind of the interesting thing now is everybody is scrambling. They're bleeding viewers, and nobody knows where to take them.
But there is this dynamic, too, that exists where they're putting original content online at the same time that they're putting it on television. So in a way, they're trying every medium to capture people out there.
Just throwing everything against the wall and seeing what sticks. But nobody really knows what the magic formula is anymore, and who it's really going to be hurting are actors. The actor strike is coming up in June. Writers have been hurt by this. People who are trying to create new and original content are really over a barrel. We as viewers are going to be feeling that because, sure, it's great to watch something on YouTube that some guy did filmed on his Nokia, but it's not Battlestar Galactica.
It's not Panavision.
It's not the same kind of experience, and that, you know, DIY amateur stuff is great, but, you know, that's not the same as the kind of excitement and production values that you get from television.
Knight Rider, that's excitement?
The remake of Knight Rider, and also there's a new
Knight Rider, Beverly that's the car Hill, that talks.
The talking car is coming back, and Beverly Hills 90210 sequel coming back. You've been waiting for that. 10 years in the making.
90212.
You mean a sequel as into they've all grown up and what are they doing now type
sequel?
It's a
spin-off kind of a thing.
Huh. Yeah.
Set your
talking
TiVo.
Cars. Have they ever heard of GPS at the networks?
Yep. No, everybody loves a talking car.
Mary Elizabeth Williams, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. It is Friday, and that means it's movie day. And here on The Takeaway, as part of our public service, we don't make you listen to all the trailers of all the movies that are being released this week. No, we put them together in the mother of all trailers. And so, for week three of The Takeaway, the mother of all trailer.
On the road to America, a fugitive meets up with an unsuspecting stranger.
I am Prince Caspian.
What happened here?
But where one of them sees hope...
Narnia is about to be annihilated.
The other sees opportunity.
Have you ever kissed a girl? Do you want to?
Who are you?
In America, you can start a new life.
Everything you know is about to change.
Unless somebody else gets there first.
The mother
of all trailers.
It's amazing how that voice sounds exactly the same on three trailers. It was only three trailers, folks.
Yeah, three trailers, three movies this week. You know, between Speed Racer last week and Indiana Jones next week, this is a bit of a desert weekend. Mary Elizabeth Williams, our culture correspondent here at The Takeaway, we're going to make you play the art escape game here on the movies, okay? Here's how it goes. Adore's going to give you a movie. She's going to describe it a little bit. You're going to decide not whether it's good or bad, but whether it is an art movie or whether you go to it to escape.
Or do you want to escape from it?
Escape. Well, we can get to that, but let's just start with what the movie is. The Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspi, it sounded like he said, but I thought it was Caspian. Yeah. However,
there's an N.
The good guy, Ben Barnes, now he must return to his rightful throne to Narnia after being displaced by an evil king. Lucky for him, the lion and some others show up to help him out. And interestingly enough, we got Liam Neeson, good, well-known,
voice of Aslan,
very well-respected actor, and Tilda Swinton. Art or escape?
I think it's escape that wants to be art. Is my it's 2.5 hours long though, so ooh, that is something you do want to escape from. 2.5. I just.
Kids love it, but it's a parent killer.
Listen, if I could keep my kids quiet for 2.5 hours, that would be
great.
I'd be happy for that. So I think it's aspiring to probably more than it
but probably
be.
Escape. All right, here's movie number two, How the Garcia Girls Spent Their Summers. Ugly Betty's America Ferrera falls in love for the first time while her mother and grandmother have their romantic sparks rekindled by new boyfriends. It's in a sleepy Arizona town, all about gossip. What do you think, art or escape?
I think it's definitely, that's going to be escape. It's just girly, fun, crying.
The chick flick.
Chick flicks that you just cannot kill the chick flick. We can try and try. Iron Man should go after that. That's what I want Iron Man to walk into the movie and be their boyfriend and blow everybody up.
John, why don't you take the next one?
All right, Reprise. Two best friends want to be successful authors. One has a nervous breakdown after his first novel is published. The other can't get anyone to print a single word of his. Is it art? Is it escape? Hint, Norwegian subtitles.
Art.
Yeah, Scandinavian. And the director's last name is Trier. It's art, art, art.
It's totally art.
It's art with an umlaut.
Completely art. All right, well, we want your reviews of movies. So if you see movies this weekend, go to the website, takeaway.org, leave your reviews, 6-word reviews, and we'll put them in our feature called Words of Mouth. And then you can be a part of the Takeaway community assessing what is the best movie. And, you know, it's 1 week away till Indiana Jones. So we'll see you next week on the Takeaway Mother of All mashup movie art escape home games.
Umlaut.
Thank you, Mary Elizabeth.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. On this Friday, May 16th, we've been covering what's the latest developments are in Myanmar in the aftermath of the cyclone. And we've been asking folks, Myanmar's military is blocking aid. What should the United States do? We've got many responses. Listen.
Hello, this is Lauren Amston in Manhattan, and I'm calling to say that the United States, other government organizations, should paint the relief ships white, the helicopters white, the airplanes white, and simply go in and deliver the supplies. I just cannot believe that the military of Myanmar would fire on these people. Okay, go.
Good morning. This is Troy Erickson calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I think the obvious commentary to make on the what to do about Myanmar question is that if we can justify an invasion and an occupation of Iraq, then certainly we can justify an invasion to save potentially millions of lives.
Keep your answers coming, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can always send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And right now it's time for more headlines from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Hello there to you, Adora. Good morning to all. The Commerce Department have reported just in the last 20 minutes that the construction of new homes has posted the biggest increase in more than 2 years in April. And this is a rare bit of good news in what has been the worst downturn in housing in more than two decades. also making news, a new Al-Qaeda tape, apparently of Osama bin Laden, has been released onto the internet. It asks his supporters to not give up a single inch of Palestine. There have been new aftershocks from Monday's catastrophic earthquake in China, and they're causing more damage. The latest tremors have cut off roads and knocked out communications. The confirmed death toll is more than 19,500 now, and Chinese officials say that they could expect this number to double. Zimbabwe's runoff election between President Robert Mugabe and the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai will be held on June the 27th. The date can't come soon enough for the opposition spokesperson Tendai Biti, who says the people of Zimbabwe are suffering.
It was about 7 o'clock at night, and the wind it blew with all its might, and the rain came pouring down, and the dark clouds seemed to frown.
Now, if you know the opposition spokesman Tendai Biti, you'll know that that wasn't him. That's a story we'll be bringing you just a little bit later. Zimbabwe's presidential elections were held at the end of March the 29th, and after weeks of delays, Morgan Tsvangirai was declared the winner. He didn't win by a big enough majority, though, to avoid a runoff vote. In sports news, defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs topped the New Orleans Hornets last night to tie up the series and force a decisive Game 7 in the semi-finals. And a second leg of racing's Triple Crown opens tomorrow. The Preakness Kentucky Derby winner, Big Brown, is an overwhelming early favourite. And finally, you had a little sneak preview of it earlier. That was the work of a man who has been called the worst poet in the world. He is going to auction today. William McGonnell wrote such gems as The Tay Bridge Disaster. You had a little listen earlier. Dylan, do we have time to play it again?
Oh, no, geez, please don't. Please.
I know,
please,
John, you love poetry and you write a little bit.
Yeah.
Do
please.
You know how much his works are going for? He was derided when he used to write this poetry. It's going for $12,000.
Okay, well, that's great for
him.
He
had the last laugh.
I'm really happy for him. Thank you, Femi. Just what we need, bad poetry on our program here, The Takeaway. We thought we would leave you with a discussion of something which is actually crucial to civilization. I think back to my first job. Okay, it was at a car wash. But my first job in an office, I went in, they gave me a place to work, to sit down. I looked around. I went, wow, this is great. I stood up. I could see all my fellow employees over the walls of all the cubicles, and it began the slow erosion of my brain. Yes, the cubicle, the office cubicle that we all know and love, turns 40 today. And to help us understand what this means, Debbie Millman, partner of Sterling Brands and host of the internet radio show Design Matters, is here with us. Mary Elizabeth Williams is still with us. I guess we all know cubicles, right? They've turned 40. Are we happy about that, or are we really sad about that, Debbie?
Well, I think primarily we're pretty sad, but the irony is that cubicles were actually born out of a rather noble effort. Robert Probst, who is the creator, the inventor of the cubicle in 1968, created the cubicle out of a truly utopian, egalitarian vision, which was to allow for a more free-flowing exchange of ideas and information. And it was created in a time when there was no internet or no email. And Intel was the first company that brought the cubicle into their offices.
Well, they did all right.
Well, it was a time when corporate culture was really changing. Companies were abandoning the dress codes, and there was flexible time that was being brought into the workplace. And the designer of the cubicle felt that people could see more of their work if it was actually spread out in front of them, and that this nook could be something that was used for personal expression. It was open to collaborative expression in that you could look over the top of the
collaborate with your
that didn't really end up
neighbors.
Happening. This notion of utopia kind of went awry somewhere.
Well, you know, it wasn't conceived to go awry. It was conceived to create more of a collaborative effort, but it was driven that way by economics. The Galt Global Review did a study on why office design matters a couple of years ago and determined that cubicles reduce person-to-person communication. They actually create a big, steep decline in morale.
Because
when people
kind
sit
of
in them.
They hide in there.
They're
cubicles.
Uninspiring. They're dehumanizing.
They huddle.
They become very territorial about their space. They don't want to leave. And actually, it even showed, this review showed, that there were production delays via the use of people working in...
Totally backfire, at least according to that survey.
So, Denny, why are they still so persistent?
Because they're cheap, because they're modular, because they don't create a lot of labor. They're not labor-intensive in the creation. They are more efficient, space efficient. You can put more people in spaces. And as a matter of fact, the original cubicles were created, designed with 250 square feet.
Which is about the size of your average studio
Manhattan,
here.
Manhattan,
it's a
four-bedroom
apartment in Manhattan. Yeah.
And then they were reduced about 15 or so years ago to about 190 square feet. And urban office planners have now determined that the cubicle could actually be reduced another 21%.
Downsizing cubicles.
But you have to wonder if people's response and morale will plummet at that same percentage as you take away more and more space from their little universe.
Well, I was looking at some of the Flickr pictures that were sent in, and there was a picture that was sent in
to our website, where
a man was sitting at a cubicle, and the cubicle wall behind him was so close to his chair, I do not think he could swerve back and get out. I think he had to climb over the armrest in order to get out of his
chair. Maybe there's a camera mounted in the cubicle. Well, I love this territorial idea. Have you ever bought like a big giant plant in your cubicle and it sort of impinges on maybe your neighbor?
No.
Anything like that?
Well, I saw one of the other pictures where a woman had a vase full of bamboo. And for those that are familiar with bamboo, bamboo is one of the fastest growing plants. And I think that this is her effort to create some camouflage to not have to see her neighbor. Robert Probst was so embarrassed by this invention that before he died, he actually apologized for his invention and apologized for what he called the monolithic insanity of the cubicle.
It's not funny, but gee, there's some giant irony there. And of course, I mean, we're not going back. The cubicles are not going away for all those reasons that you just listed.
Yeah. There are some...
That's so sad. I mean, Robert Probst, is there anything you'd like to say?
Well, first of all,
I apologize for the cubicle.
They perverted my invention. Yes.
Well, there would be no Dilbert if there were no cubicles.
Right. Well, we have to get to one final little thing. We want to give Mary Elizabeth Williams a chance to redeem herself. I have been chastised on the internet already for saying
there was an upcoming actor strike. It is a possible strike. So I apologize.
Because a listener corrected us in saying that SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, is still negotiating. Yeah. And I think he runs a film company is hoping that they will resolve things.
He's sitting at a cubicle somewhere.
As we all are.
Firing off angry emails.
And mentioning that, I think that we should also say that on our website you'll find a picture of our offices, which are a step below cubicles. I think that's how we could describe it.
Postmodern cubicle. Yeah, something like that. Yes,
picture something out of the Matrix.
Right. And here's just a little, you know, in celebration of the cubicle's birthday.
Oh, wait a second. We also have this great... Steve tells us he used to be a temp worker designing the adverts that went into a phone book, and he was in a cubicle. It was making him crazy, and after about 6 weeks, he couldn't stand it, so he left for greener pastures. He said, fast forward 8 years later, I'm now working with my wife, and she keeps talking about how she wants her own cubicle and our small two-person office.
Send all your stuff all weekend to us at thetakeaway.org. Mary Beth Williams is writing a blog about the new TV season. Debbie Millman of Design Matters, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You can download our entire show as an MP3 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Keep your comments coming. We read everything. We're The Takeaway.
Have a good weekend.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.